So he said, Gertie, you have broken the Third International. And he went out with tears running down his cheek. Gertie said, I don't think he'll ever come back. I said, don't worry, he'll come back because this is where he gets his food. He didn't have any money. I said, this is where he gets his food. He'll come back. And at 12 o'clock he came back and went to the kitchen to find out what.
Well, Barbara, you didn't believe in physically disciplining children. You never did.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. If they did something, sure I did. You know, that's one of the things I never forgave myself. And when my little girl was dying, and I said, Helen, you must get well because I love you so. And she said, if you love me, why did you touch me?
Oh.
And, you know, I can't tell you how sometimes it would come to me that I couldn't sleep. I would go over just feeling sick. Agony.
It wasn't that you didn't not believe in disciplining the children.
Oh, no. I believed. I've seen undisciplined children, and I thought they were only brats.
Mm-hmm.
No, I believed in it.
Well, you know. Barbara, did he... So you continued basically to support the family. He did not contribute to
the support. No, he didn't support. No, he didn't give it to his own support. But when he worked in the market, he'd bring fruit and vegetables home, but that's all.
Did he continue to do that, to sell the fruit and vegetables?
Oh, he brought that. But at that time, you know, carrots were a penny a bunch, beets were a penny a bunch, apples were 3 pounds for a dime. Before he didn't amount to them. Round steak was 2 pounds for 25 cents.
But that's what he continued to do then, was to sell the fruit and vegetables?
He works in the market.
I see. And then you remained married and lived together until he was deported then?
Well, he never supported me. Because he never, but then he finally got a job that paid something, so he gave me $5 a week.
Oh, he kept all the rest of it?
Yeah, but he never earned very much, but he kept the rest of it. Well, the car took a lot, you know, it's quite a bit to take care of, and the union dues and everything.
I see.
And then, you know, he liked to, for instance, when they made a collection for the party and everything, when he had so little, he would take care of a $20 bill and say, unless you're, you know, he kind of a show guy, you know.
But you basically got along fairly well all those years?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, otherwise pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Well, when he was deported then in 1956, you said?
Yes.
And you never thought about going back with him?
No. I wouldn't leave my family. Mm-hmm. I care more about them than about him. But I didn't dislike him.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there were some things he did. He loved all the children and always wanted to help in any way he could with them. Francis said once when he came to Berkeley and Stevie had been very, very sick, they had to put him in water every 5 minutes, you know, his fever was so high. And she said she was ready to collapse when Peggy came there. His son is a doctor, you know, and lives there, you know. His son is a psychiatrist. So, Peggy stayed up all night long. She said, if not for Peggy, I don't know what I would have done, because he was wonderful in that. Stayed up all night because I was ready to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved all the children. See, he loved Nancy and Bob Burnett's son. He had a great admiration for my son, too. My son never liked him very much.
Well, how did you feel when he then left in 56? Did you think he was coming back or not?
I knew he would never get back. Okay. The Supreme Court had issued that he couldn't get the Social Security, which was by his. One of my grandson's sweethearts was taking the law. One of the things that they in the law you have to learn was the case of Nestor. Because his was the first case where they took away the Social Security and you couldn't get it back because that was unheard of before.
Was this still under the Smith Act?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, no, that was, he had nothing to do with the Smith Act. See, when he was deported, they said that he had He was a communist when he came in 1913.
Oh, I see.
In 1913, there was no communist party. So you know that was in the Bosnian.
Oh, so in other words, he had entered under false...
No, he didn't even enter. He was perfectly legal when he came.
What
in
they were saying,
but they would never have deported him except they were getting back a Dorothy.
I see.
It's not for for that, you know. Mm-hmm. They would never have touched him. He never did anything. I tell you, the most he ever did was to go with the people's work, and then they were afraid to send him with that after he had experienced with black women.
Well, Barbara, how did you feel when he was deported and you knew you weren't going to be seeing him again?
Well, I thought he wanted to go. Uh-huh. You see, he had a feeling that if he ever wanted to come back, he'd come back.
Uh-huh.
You see, there's nothing so much of self-delusion about your policies. And everyone, my friends, and Rose Chernin from the Born, told him, you'll never be able to come back because the Supreme Court passed this thing because they're deporting. See, what he did, he didn't tell us. He was tricky in many ways. He had written to a friend of his who was in the ministry in Bulgaria that he had a right that he doesn't want to go back to Bulgaria because no socialist country would give a visa to anyone to break up families. But he said, but I really do want to come to Bulgaria and see what's going on in my country. So, see what you can do. So, this friend that he had written this said, what you didn't know is that my brother, who was only a little boy when you left for America, is now in the ministry, and he will send you a visa. So they sent a visa, and that's how he could go.
Oh, I see.
That's how they could deport him, otherwise they couldn't. And then he thought that if they were paying for his $600. He was saving $600. He was getting the best of the American government. Whenever he got ready, he was sure that he could come back whenever he wanted to. So he wrote to me and said to me, after a few years, he found out that the woman that he had known in high school, he told me she had been his sweetheart. He hardly knew her. It was all in his mind. Well, she threw him out of the house. She didn't want him around at all. Threw his clothes and everything out of the house and told him to get working at her. And so he wrote, but Barbie, why don't you help me? Why don't you see, after all, Ed is a lawyer and you have friends amongst the lawyers. Help me to get back. So I wrote to the Social Security offices in Washington and said you deported him under false pretenses because there was no Communist Party in 1913. I think it's very unfair of you, and he wants to come back. So I got a letter from San Francisco from the head of the Social Security from there. They said, I'm coming down to Los Angeles, and I will be at the State Building, not for your case, Mrs. Nestor, but as long as I have to come down anyway, I will grant you an audience. So come and bring your lawyer if you wish for anything, and I will answer any question you have. So I took Mandel, who was one of our lawyers, and we went down, and I said, now you know that there was no Communist Party at that time. He said, I wanted to ask you a question. How old was he when he came to America? I said, 23. Why didn't he ever become a citizen? I said, well, I've forgotten his name already. I said, well, it's hard to explain a person like my husband. One of Dickens' characters would answer for him, but he had a saying that the whole world is his country. And I said, but you're not Tom Paine. You're living right here, and you're not Tom Paine, so you become a citizen. And that's why he didn't become a citizen, because when he came there, you know that there wasn't. He says, well, Mrs. Nestor, I'll tell you something. I only carry out orders. I'm not the head of the Social Security, and in the Supreme Court, it's awfully hard when the Supreme Court passes whatever it is, it's awfully hard to change it. You'd have to have a whole lot more influence than I have. I agree with you that it's a rotten law. It isn't right. If you and your friends could go ahead and change it, I'd be very happy. But there's nothing I can do for it. So your husband is a crackpot. But, you know, the laws are not made only for crackpots. there's nothing I can do. Now your husband is there. He isn't there very happy there. But there he will remain. He can't come back because there's nothing I can do about it. I came, I granted you the audience, and I agree with you, it's a rotten law. I don't think it's just law, but I don't make the laws and I can't alter them. I only carry them out. So I wrote him that, said, yeah, I went down there, I did all whatever I could. There's nothing that Ed Newman can do, even though he's a lawyer. For one thing, it has to, you know, lawyers have different fields. That happens now. But if it was his field, he couldn't do anything about it. I told Dorothy, it seems so ridiculous that they would deprive him of all that. But when he died, then I get the same kind of because I only got half of what he was getting. Mm-hmm. Then I got a further amount than him. Now I get $114 a month. Before I was only getting $37 or $39.
How did you feel when you knew that you weren't going to be seeing him again?
Well, I felt a deep resentment against him for wanting to go. And if he wanted to go and everything, and then he would write to me, then, you know, and everything, because he would always say, Bobby, for you I'd give my life. I said, I don't want your life. All I want you to be is just more thoughtful and other things.
Mm-hmm. Have a look. He was rather changeable.
Yes, he was. But for instance, when he worked in Inglewood, he'd come home sometimes at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. He'd meet someone there, and they'd get talking, and he'd go ahead to their home, drink tea and everything. I said, Peggy, you're through at 12 at midnight, you're through. Why don't you come right home then? She said, well, I meet someone. You want to tell me that I have no right to stay out as long as... I said, Peggy, the only time you have the right to do just exactly what you please is when you live alone. When you live with someone else, you lose some of that liberty. It's one of the things you pay for, living with someone. And you can't always have your way. You can do anything you please, Peggy, but if you're going to stay out till 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, you'll have to move. Then you can go whatever you please. Nobody's going to bother you. The door is unlocked. You don't have to stay here. You're always free to go whenever you want to. So he never came home at 12 o'clock. But he was a cruel kind of a guy. It's hard to understand a person like that. You see what he did? He was going to go to Bulgaria and tell them how they are. If not for Dorothy, he wouldn't have gotten a pension. Dorothy went to Bulgaria, and she said, look, you had no business to allow him to come back until you asked us. Not by what he wrote a letter or anything. That is what she determined. Not that he wanted, but what you said. Now you've got him here. They took away his Social Security. Now you support him and give him a job. That's all there is to it. And they gave him a job. So each the job he got, it kind of as an interpreter. I taught him English. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so not for Dorothy, he got a better pension than many of them were. Because they told him, you're telling us what we ought to do. You were in America living high on the hog. Here we were suffering and dying and suffering so horribly. And you're telling us how we ought to run our country. Oh, you shut up and go to hell. So they soon shut him up.
Well, Barbara, it sounds like your relationship with him was very different than your relationship with Joe had been. Then.
Oh, yes. With Joe, I had no feeling. Absolutely. I knew there was no question of his love and consideration and thought, no matter what. There was no question of it. And I don't think any father could love his children more than Joe did. He sometimes embarrassed me because he thought his children were the most wonderful in the whole world. Hi, sis.
Did you feel close to Nestor Tudor?
Not as close as to Joe. I had never had any question of Joe, but I always thought of Nestor as a very shallow person. Mm-hmm. You know. You see, there was a difference to now. If he was your friend, if you would call him up in the middle of the night that you needed help, he'd come right there to do anything good for you. But he wouldn't hesitate to have you do it for him, too. Mm-hmm. So, see, It's so different, so hard to explain a person who has so many facets to him, and some utterly stupid, I mean, yet something, he would laugh at the, when they said, show the face of the party. You show the face of the party and lose your job. What did his dad do? He took a smart remark, because it was true.
Well, was he ever, did he mainly follow you, or was he ever independent in his thinking about the party? Or was he mainly following you or Dorothy?
I don't think he ever followed. He would follow me much more than Dorothy. But he would be, when he'd listen and everything, he says, well, I agree with that, you know. You wouldn't have any quarrel and everything. I said, but Sophie, why don't you read it for yourself? So he'd say, well, Barbie, you know, you read it and you understand it a little bit better than I do and everything. But I'll read it if you want me to. But it's better. But I'll tell you one thing he had. He absolutely had courage. We were on a picket line, and the policeman had been kind of mean, you know, and everything. He was just ahead of us, you know, when, you know, I told you he had that horrible habit of his. He went near that policeman. Then quick as a flash, I don't know how, he was right back at me. The policeman turned around, and he said, did you do that? He jumped. He said, do what? He said, did you kick me? He said, now, officer, would I kick an officer of the law if he wants to defend me? I wouldn't think of it. What makes you think I would do a thing like that? He says, well, you were. He says, well, I was right here, the officer. You saw I was right here. I don't know how he acted so quickly, but he didn't hesitate one moment. So, you know, when we had staying with us, a longshoreman who had been accused of murder, and he was so scared to death about everything, you know. He would, if he stayed at my house, believe me, he almost was insane. And Small Numbers was his name. And it was the thing that afterward they tried Francis' husband, Dick Webster, too, on murder charges, which were a frivolous. It wasn't true, you know. The police themselves did the killing.
When was this, Barbara?
This was about 1941, I think, or something. So Claude was staying with us. And I'll tell you, see, Meyer, he was the head of the party in San Pedro at that time. And one night, he brings this guy, Claude Smallman, to my house. The worst place he could have, because Longshoreman came to our house. It was always a fight of the headquarters, wherever we lived. But he said, this guy is scared, and they're trying to arrest him, and I had a, can you stay here? I said, yes, you can stay here. But I said, Milo, now Milo is a multimillionaire, lives in the Muir Woods. He just came back from, he's the one that gave me the $10. So he said, Claude Smallman, I said, what did he do? He says, well, never mind, it's a frame-up. The next morning, I go out and pick up the Los Angeles News, and there's a picture of Claude right there saying, a murderer on the loose that they're on the lookout for, a longshoreman who is accused of murder and all that. And I come in and show Fedja, and look, Fedja, this is our guest, Claude. He said, well, don't let him see that. If he sees that, he'll go to pieces worse than ever. But he is fidgety as it was. So I put the paper away and didn't let him see it. But the little, when we were walking, you know, he'd always look around and everything in the TV. So one time he said he was sure that he heard something. So Peggy, after all, didn't know it. He went out and looked all around. That, you know, if anyone had been there, he'd have been clubbed. But he had, in that respect, he had a great deal of courage. He went anywhere or anything. So there was nobody there, nothing. So finally, Claude said he wants to go away, that we should take him out of the city I forgot now, one about 40 or 50 miles away, San Bernardino or someplace. And from there, he would take the train and go into Arizona and there gradually. And then if he would write, he would give just a different name altogether. So then when Maya brought him, he said his name. I said, as far as I saw the cloth stiffened up, I said, I don't want him to know his name. As far as I'm concerned, he's Mr. O'Connell. I knew a socialist in Oakland who was a newspaperman, O'Connell. So then I saw him and everything. And we took him out of the city, and at the time, he wore the dark glasses, and he was sitting next to me. And every time he saw a policeman, he's watching me, he's watching me. I said, no, he isn't watching you, he isn't watching at all. He's watching the road to see how he can pin a traffic ticket on someone. And I tell you that we are so glad to get rid of him, you know. Now, he was in the same thing that Francis' husband was also accused of, you know. And he was in the penitentiary for something in Portland. And then, so he wrote me a letter that he wants me to correspond with him. And one of the people who had never been in jail, but one of them also from the International Labor Defense, said to me, do you want to write to Claude? I said, I never want to write to Claude, and I don't want to have anything to do with Claude. I know, why in the hell does he keep on writing to me, you know, and everything. So I said, here, I just got a letter from him, and tell him that I don't want to write. You know, I would only get into trouble for no purpose. Claude is crazy.